Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive, the place where we turn massive stacks of research and biography into concentrated, usable knowledge. Today, we are undertaking, well, a really deep dive into the complex life and career of Angelina Jolie. She's a figure whose global influence extends so far past the entertainment industry.
It's an extraordinary file to sift through, really, because her life is effectively a series of successful, and I mean successful, transformations. We're tracking a trajectory that moves from, you know, Hollywood's self-described punk outsider and troubled young star.
The one who openly discussed self-harm and substance abuse.
Exactly. From that to a serious, incredibly effective global diplomat and filmmaker.
So the narrative mission today is pretty critical. We want to unpack the strategy behind this decades-long pivot. How exactly did she convert this immense and, let's be honest, often chaotic celebrity?
Oh, absolutely chaotic.
From her action star persona and the defining Brangelina fame into significant political and humanitarian influence, earning titles like Special Envoy and Honorary Dame Commander.
And we have sources covering the entirety of her life. I mean, the emotional instability of her youth, the astronomical success as the world's highest paid actress, her disciplined transition into directing films about conflict.
Her over 40 field missions for the UN, which is just staggering.
It is. And of course, the astonishing public health ripple effect from her personal medical decisions, the phenomenon famously known as the Angelina effect. So let's look at the mechanisms she employed to create, really, a unique modern playbook for leveraging fame.
Let's begin where the research suggests the trauma and the talent both originated: her early life. Angelina Jolie was born Angelina Jolie Voight on June 4th, 1975, to two major Hollywood figures, John Voight and Marceline Bertrand. But, you know, despite that lineage, her start was anything but privileged in the traditional sense.
That's so right. The family connections were certainly deep. I mean, her godparents were the legendary Jacqueline Bisset and Maximilian Schell, but the family structure itself was unstable from the very beginning.
From day one.
Her parents separated in 1976. She was just a baby. She and her brother, James Haven, were raised by their mother, Marceline, who actually made the decision to step away from her own acting career entirely just to focus on raising them.
And this choice, as the sources all note, it profoundly shaped Jolie's career motivation. Her desire to act wasn't really inspired by her famous distant father. It was inspired by watching films with her mother, who was sort of living vicariously through the art she'd given up.
Right. And even though she had that tiny, uncredited role in her father's 1982 film, Looking to Get Out, her early life was defined by the separation, not by any kind of collaboration with him.
We also find a specific detail in the background that really hints at that fractured family dynamic. She has confirmed German and Slovak descent from her father's side and Dutch and French ancestry from her mother.
But the sources note that her claimed distant indigenous Iroquois ancestry, which stemmed from her French-Canadian mother, was publicly and, I mean, controversially disputed by John Voight himself.
He claimed they had made it up.
Yes. He claimed they had made it up years ago to make Marceline seem more exotic. It just shows the level of tension present, you know, even when discussing basic family heritage.
Wow. And that tension was compounded by her educational experience. She did train at the Lee Strasberg Theater Institute, but when she attended Beverly Hills High School, she felt intensely isolated.
This wasn't the typical Hollywood teen experience at all. She was reportedly teased, not because of her celebrity parents, but because she was much thinner than her peers and wore glasses and braces in an environment that was obsessed with wealth and, you know, perfect appearance.
That experience pushed her into a kind of a self-imposed exile from that whole culture. She transferred to Moreno High School, an alternative school, and cultivated the image of punk outsider.
And this era is so crucial for understanding her early public identity. She wore all black, she was going to moshing venues, and critically, began engaging in these self-destructive behaviors, including knife play, often with a live-in boyfriend.
So that rebellious, extreme image was clearly rooted in some very deep feelings of isolation.
Absolutely.
This period of intense internal struggle, it really informed her early public persona. And we need to dedicate some time to the depth of this turmoil. It's just so central to her later transformation. This was not just teenage rebellion. This was a real crisis.
The sources are very graphic about her state of mind. As a teenager, she struggled with this profound emotional disconnection. The resulting self-harm was a desperate attempt to cope. She described the pain and the ritual of cutting herself as somehow therapeutic. It was a way to force a sense of feeling or release when she otherwise felt numb.
And the struggle spiraled dramatically from there. She battled severe insomnia, an eating disorder, and the use of substances escalated very quickly.
Very quickly. The record shows that by age 20, she had admitted to using just about every drug possible. And she specifically named heroin as a drug she heavily used during that time.
The depression reached, just catastrophic levels, culminating in multiple suicide plans.
She planned suicide twice, once at 19 and again at 22. The most shocking detail in the sources is her attempt to hire a hitman to kill her at age 22.
A hitman.
She later explained it was partly an attempt to avoid the guilt for her family, the guilt associated with a conventional suicide. She saw it as a way to die without being responsible for the direct action.
That is just an incredible level of desperation.
It is. And it led finally to a nervous breakdown at age 24, resulting in a 72-hour admission to a psychiatric ward for observation.
That's an astonishing amount of internal chaos. So if that was the absolute lowest point, what was the definitive turning point that allowed her to regain control and find some stability?
It was the absolute commitment required by motherhood. After she adopted her first child, Maddox, in 2002, that self-destructive spiral it halted completely.
Completely.
She stated it very clearly. She found stability in the responsibility. I knew once I committed to Maddox, I would never be self-destructive again. That commitment provided the necessary focus and external anchor that ended decades of internal struggle.
We also have to detail the lifelong dysfunctional relationship she had with her father, John Voight. While the trouble started when he left the family, they did attempt a reconciliation.
Right, when they start together in Lara Croft, Tomb Raider in 2001.
Exactly.
But that reconciliation was volatile and very brief. The relationship quickly deteriorated after Voight went public during a TV appearance, claiming she had serious mental problems and needed help.
A public betrayal like that.
It was the last straw. In response, Jolie legally removed the Voight surname in 2002. They entered a period of total estrangement, not speaking for 6.5 years. They only began to rebuild their relationship after her mother, Marshalene Bertrand, passed away in 2007. This legal separation was a profound move toward establishing her own identity.
And her own psychological boundaries.
Precisely.
So once she committed to stability and fully committed to her craft, her professional ascent was just meteoric. Let's track that path from a struggling, intense young actor to the world's highest paid movie star.
She began focusing professionally at age 16, but her inherent intensity was actually a barrier for her initially. She struggled greatly with auditions, frequently being told her demeanor was simply too dark or too intense.
Too dark. You hear that a lot in the sources. So she took alternative work. She appeared in 5 student films made by her brother, and notably, she leveraged her distinctive look in the 90s music scene, appearing in several high-profile music videos.
Oh yeah, for huge artists. We're talking about videos for Lenny Kravitz, Meatloaf, and famously the Rolling Stones' Anybody Seen My Baby?
Where she played a stripper who suddenly leaves mid-performance.
That's the one. She also appeared on a Widespread Panic album cover. She was everywhere in that kind of alternative culture.
Her first major professional film roles were not immediate successes, though. Her first leading role was in the direct-to-video sci-fi sequel See Cyborg 2 in 1993. A film she later said she was so disappointed with that she stopped auditioning for a full year.
She realized she needed to be highly selective, and the true breakthrough came with Hackers in 1995. Even though it failed at the box office, it quickly developed this massive cult following, and for the first time, critics really acknowledged her unique power. The New York Times highlighted how she stands out from her co-stars.
So that role defined her as a specific, powerful presence, even if the film itself was pretty niche at the time.
And that presence was increasingly noted by critics in more serious roles. In the 1996 film Foxfire, she played Legs, a drifter. A critic noted she possessed the sheer screen presence to overcome the stereotype of the role.
So she's showcasing this raw, natural ability to command attention.
Yes. This marked the beginning of her transition from a curiosity into a serious dramatic talent, someone capable of inhabiting these intense, complex characters.
Okay, so this three-year window, from 97 to 2000, this is where she really cemented her reputation in Hollywood. She stopped being the dark actor and became the intense, complex talent, and a lot of that happened through television initially.
Precisely. She won a Golden Globe for portraying Cornelia Wallace in the 1997 TV film George Wallace, which really set the stage for her most critically defining TV role as the supermodel Gia Carangi in HBO's Gia in 1998.
And Gia was a monumental performance. It was a harrowing portrait of the model's descent into drug addiction and her eventual death from AIDS. Critics were just effusive. They called her performance fierce and declared the tragic character quite possibly the most beautiful train wreck ever filmed.
And the awards just followed. Her second consecutive Golden Globe and her first Screen Actors Guild Award. And the level of commitment involved was so intense, you know, reflecting the methods of the Strasberg training she received. She used method acting, fully immersing herself in the character's isolation.
Didn't she tell her husband at the time, Johnny Lee Miller, that she couldn't even call him?
That's right. She famously told him she couldn't call, explaining the level of emotional distance she needed. I'm alone. I'm dying. I'm gay. I'm not going to see you for weeks. The emotional toll was so great that she actually declared she was quitting acting immediately afterward, feeling she had nothing else to give.
But she returned pretty quickly to take on the supporting role of the sociopathic Lisa Rowe in Girl. Interrupted.
A perfect role for her.
It really was. This role leveraged her natural intensity perfectly. Roger Ebert praised her emergence as one of the great wild spirits of current movies, a loose cannon who somehow has deadly aim.
That performance led to a complete sweep of the major awards, the Academy Award, Golden Globe, and SAG Award for Best Supporting Actress. This validated her as a top-tier dramatic actress. And importantly, she immediately followed this highly emotional, demanding role with a very calculated commercial move.
The summer blockbuster Gone in 60 Seconds.
Exactly, which grossed over $237 million, proving she could handle action and star power just as well as she could handle intense drama.
So this next decade is characterized by a massive strategic shift, leveraging that Oscar-winning credibility into global box office superstardom. And the pivot was centered on one role, Lara Croft.
Lara Croft. Tomb Raider in 2001 was the ignition point. It was huge. She trained extensively in martial arts. She mastered an English accent for the part. And although critics were mixed on the film itself, her physical performance was widely lauded. The film grossed nearly $275 million worldwide, instantly transforming her into the world's premier female action star.
A truly global icon.
Yeah.
And the financial impact of this shift was immediate and dramatic. By 2002, she had cemented her place among Hollywood's highest-paid actresses.
She was commanding salaries of $10 to $15 million per film. That figure later increased to $15 to $20 million by 2008. This commercial power was the fuel for her later diplomatic platform.
And the box office hits just kept coming, demonstrating her magnetic appeal. Mr. and Mrs. Smith in 2005, opposite Brad Pitt, was a near $500 million global success.
And the film's power wasn't just in the action, was it? It was in the real-life curiosity surrounding the stars, generating what critics called thermonuclear screen chemistry.
Right, and catapulting the Brangelina phenomenon into the global stratosphere.
Subsequent action hits followed, confirming her bankability. You Have Wanted in 2008, which grossed over $340 million internationally. And critically, Salt in 2010 demonstrated her power to shape these projects. That script was originally written for Tom Cruise.
For Tom Cruise. And they changed the gender for her.
They changed the gender of the main character for her, and it resulted in a global success that brought in over $293 million.
But the sources also confirm that she maintained a clear strategy to balance these explosive action roles with serious, demanding, dramatic work. This was essential for her to maintain her critical credibility.
Absolutely. Roles like Marianne Pearl in A Mighty Heart and her powerhouse performance in Clint Eastwood's Changeling kept her squarely in the awards conversation.
Earning Golden Globes, SAG, and an Academy Award nomination for Best Actress. She was demonstrating that she could command massive budgets while still delivering performances for complex, serious auteurs. She successfully cornered the market in both commercial viability and critical dramatic prestige, which is an incredibly rare feat.
And, of course, you can't forget the steady success of her voice roles, particularly as Tigress in the highly lucrative Kung Fu Panda franchise and her earlier work in Shark Tale. That just added another layer of consistent professional output during this decade.
The sources indicate a major personal shift occurred after her mother's death in 2007. This prompted her to appear in fewer films, and she stated her initial motivation for acting had largely been tied to fulfilling her mother's aspirations. So this marks the perfect inflection point for her move behind the camera, a creative pivot that allows her artistic output to align directly with her deep-seated global advocacy.
It's a very intentional transition. Directing allowed her to control the narrative and focus on the stories she cared about most, namely those involving global conflict and human rights crises, themes that traditional acting roles rarely provided.
Her first feature directorial debut, In the Land of Blood and Honey from 2011, set during the Bosnian War, was conceived purely to generate awareness for the survivors and victims of sexual violence during that conflict.
The authenticity she strived for was remarkable. She made the decision to use only actors from the former Yugoslavia, and she incorporated their own wartime experiences into the script itself. While critics were mixed, you know, some found the atmosphere compelling, others felt the subject matter was too difficult. It was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Foreign Language Film.
But the real marker of its success for her was the result. She was named an honorary citizen of Sarajevo for raising awareness of the war's atrocities.
Exactly. Following that, she took on the complex story of WWII hero Louis Zamperini in Unbroken in 2014, which was scripted by the Coen brothers.
And Unbroken was a big jump into blockbuster level directing.
A huge jump. And while it was financially successful, the critical reception was mixed. Critics argued that despite the impeccable craftsmanship and an extraordinary source story, the film itself felt dutiful and unexceptional.
Which raises an interesting question for analysis. Was the directorial project designed purely for visibility, you know, a high-profile success to solidify her directing career? Or was the critical dismissal a sign that her powerful public humanitarian image sometimes overwhelmed her artistic credibility in the eyes of reviewers?
That's a great question. Then came By the Sea in 2015, a deeply personal marital drama where she starred opposite Brad Pitt, drawing heavily on themes related to her mother's life.
This film was a significant risk. She directed, wrote, and starred in it. It was clearly ambitious and deeply personal, but unfortunately, it was widely dismissed by critics as a vanity project.
It really was. It performed poorly commercially and got a limited release. It shows that even with her star power, critics were hesitant to embrace her in a stripped-down, purely auteur-driven context unless the topic had a clear external humanitarian focus.
But she rebounded successfully with First They Killed My Father in 2017, a drama focusing on Cambodia's Khmer Rouge era, a subject very close to her heart because of Maddox's birthplace.
This was a strategic move back toward authenticity and advocacy. It was produced for Netflix, featured an exclusively Khmer cast and script, and was primarily intended for a Cambodian audience. And this approach paid off immensely. The film earned her nominations for Best Foreign Language Film at the BAFTAs and the Golden Globes. Critics really recognized her growth, praising her as a skilled and sensitive filmmaker.
In recent years, she seems to have found a clear balance, returning to major franchises that guarantee global visibility while continuing to pursue these auteur-driven projects.
That franchise stability is so important. She reprised her titular role in Maleficent, Mistress of Evil in 2019, which was a staggering global success, grossing $490 million. And she officially joined the Marvel Cinematic Universe as the powerful warrior Thena in Eternals.
And even in that superhero genre, her character was imbued with depth. Critics noted the touching naivete in her portrayal of a warrior struggling with PTSD.
Exactly. And her continued commitment to serious acting is evident in her recent biographical film, Pablo Larraín's Maria, where she portrays opera singer Maria Callas.
That role signals that she hasn't abandoned intense dramatic performance. She's already received career best performance reviews and another Golden Globe nomination for it. This balance ensures she remains relevant across both commercial and artistic cinema.
And she's expanding her influence even further as a producer. She won the Tony Award for Best Musical in 2024 for The Outsiders, showing her production acumen extends successfully beyond cinema. And she also directed and wrote the upcoming war drama Without Blood, confirming that the themes of conflict and survival remain the central focus of her creative life.
This section is really the core of her legacy transformation. She moved from being an A-list actress to becoming a high-level diplomatic actor on the global stage, and this required strategy, commitment, and a willingness to put herself in genuine danger.
Absolutely. The genesis of the second career was her experience filming Lara Croft, Tomb Raider, back in 2001 in war-torn Cambodia. She openly credited that experience with suddenly opening her eyes and bringing her a greater, more tangible understanding of the world's humanitarian needs.
And she acted on that realization immediately. She contacted the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the UNHCR, upon her return. Her very first mission in 2001 was a punishing 18-day trip to Sierra Leone and Tanzania.
And critically, she was not just seeking media attention. She aimed to visit forgotten emergencies, crises that had fallen off the front pages.
The sources show the depth of her immediate commitment. Later that year, after meeting Afghan refugees in Pakistan, she donated $1 million to the UNHCR's emergency appeal. We have to emphasize the significance of that. This was the largest private donation the UNHCR had ever received at that time.
It instantly signaled that she was investing her massive earnings directly into the cause, and she wasn't operating under celebrity privileges. She insisted on covering all her own costs for her missions, sharing the exact same rudimentary living and working conditions as the field staff.
And over the next decade, after being named a UNHCR Goodwill Ambassador in August 2001, she completed over 40 field missions to more than 30 countries.
And these weren't safe visits either. The sources specifically note her willingness to travel to extremely dangerous war zones, including Darfur during the peak of the conflict, the Syrian-Iraqi border, and Kabul, where aid workers were actually murdered during her first visit.
To physically aid her mission, she even took flying lessons starting in 2004.
Right. She acquired a pilot license and eventually owned two aircraft, a Cirrus SR-22 and a Cessna 208 Caravan, with the explicit goal of personally ferrying aid workers and supplies to remote locations. This just demonstrates the level of infrastructure and personal involvement she created around her advocacy.
Her work then gained a clear diplomatic focus in 2012 when she was promoted to Special Envoy to the High Commissioner, Antonio Guterres, who would later become the UN Secretary General. This was a critical elevation of status.
That promotion was more than ceremonial. It granted her genuine diplomatic authority. While the Goodwill Ambassador role is focused on awareness, the Special Envoy role meant focusing on major crises, representing the High Commissioner at a government level, and engaging in high-stakes diplomatic advocacy.
For instance, she toured Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq to assess the Syrian refugee situation and met with governments to secure greater support.
And even though she resigned from the formal ambassadorship in December 2022, she immediately committed to continuing her advocacy independently.
Her work quickly expanded beyond refugee issues into large-scale conservation and community development, largely centralized in Cambodia, the birthplace of her son Maddox.
That's right. In 2003, she purchased 60,000 hectares of deforested land adjacent to the Sam Lout National Park, creating a dedicated wildlife reserve named the Maddox Jolie Pitt Foundation, or MJP. This land was previously a hub for poaching. So in a stroke of strategic genius, she expanded MJP in 2006, creating a community development model based on economist Jeffrey Sachs's Millennium Village concept.
So this wasn't simple charity. It was comprehensive community building. MJP funded the infrastructure, schools, roads, soy milk factory.
And most crucially, it employed former poachers and illegal loggers as wildlife rangers. She was transforming the economic incentives of the community, turning those who had previously degraded the environment into its primary protectors and beneficiaries.
She also supported conservation in Africa, acting as patron to the Harness Wildlife Foundation in Namibia, and, with Brad Pitt, co-established the Shiloh Jolie Pitt Foundation for conservation work in the Kalahari.
Parallel to this, her legal and child advocacy work became highly specialized in the U.S. Since 2008, she has co-chaired Kids in Need of Defense, or KIND, an organization co-founded with Microsoft.
And this is a crucial concept to define for our audience. KIND provides free legal aid to unaccompanied minors in U.S. immigration proceedings. Why is this so vital?
It's vital because under U.S. law, children facing deportation proceedings are not guaranteed a lawyer, unlike in criminal court. These minors often have to navigate incredibly complex asylum, trafficking, or removal claims entirely on their own. KINDNA quickly became the principal provider of pro bono legal representation for these vulnerable immigrant children, filling a massive gap in legal due process.
She also focused heavily on education. She co-chairs the Education Partnership for Children of Conflict, providing funding for policy support and physical schools in conflict-affected regions like Iraq and Afghanistan.
She personally funded schools for girls in Afghanistan and at the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, and she funds two children's centers, one in Phnom Penh and one in Ethiopia, dedicated to children living with HIV and tuberculosis.
And she's even expanded her mission to media literacy.
Right. She executive produced the BBC program My World, which was explicitly designed to teach teenagers how to think critically about journalism, identify bias, and distinguish quality information in an age of digital overload. She also co-authored the children's rights book Know Your Rights and Claim Them with a leading British human rights lawyer, making complex legal concepts accessible to young people.
Her ambition clearly transcended fundraising, though. She was seeking to influence foreign policy at the highest levels. She formalized this goal in 2007 by joining the Council on Foreign Relations, or CFR.
And she backed this up with practical legal infrastructure. In 2011, she established the Jolie Legal Fellowship, sponsoring networks of lawyers to advocate for human rights development in their home countries. This meant funding lawyers to focus on child protection in Haiti and democratic process development in Libya, effectively planting legal seeds that would advocate for change from within.
Her most impactful diplomatic campaign was the Preventing Sexual Violence Initiative, or PSVI, launched with then UK Foreign Secretary William Hague in 2012.
PSVI was her diplomatic masterpiece, campaigning vigorously against the use of sexual violence as a weapon of war. Her engagement was relentless and high level. She addressed the G8 foreign ministers meeting, which led to a historic declaration on the issue. Crucially, she spoke before the UN Security Council, resulting in its broadest resolution on preventing sexual violence in conflict.
Okay, so what was the practical impact of that UN resolution? For our listeners seeking concentrated knowledge, what did it actually change on the ground?
The resolutions she championed fundamentally changed international response mechanisms. They established monitoring teams, mandated specific training for UN peacekeeping and military personnel on how to respond to and document these crimes, and created specific definitions for these acts under international law. It made it much harder for perpetrators to claim impunity. This all culminated in co-chairing the massive 2014 Global Summit to End Sexual Violence and Conflict, which resulted in a protocol endorsed by 151 nations.
It's a massive shift in global consensus.
A huge shift. This expertise was later formalized academically. In 2016, she was appointed a visiting professor at the London School of Economics. And her dedication to global policy was recognized when she was appointed an honorary dame commander by Queen Elizabeth II in 2014.
An extremely rare honor for a non-British citizen.
Exactly. Domestically, she has been an active voice in Washington, D.C. She advocated strongly for the Violence Against Women Reauthorization Act, focusing on the need for trauma-informed court processes in domestic violence cases. She also championed Kaden's Law.
And for those unfamiliar with it, Kaden's Law is crucial because it addresses the systemic problem where children in custody cases are often returned to abusive parents. The law requires courts to consider evidence of domestic violence and prioritize the child's safety.
Exactly. She also pushed for the Justice for All Reauthorization Act of 2022, aimed at improving victims' rights across the U.S. and, importantly, addressing the notorious national backlog of rape kits.
Finally, we must maintain impartiality and report on her engagement in recent global crises as documented in the sources. Following the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022, she visited Ukrainian children hospitalized in Italy and Lviv.
The source material also documents her strong criticism of Israel's military actions in Gaza in 2023. Her public statement condemned what she called the deliberate bombing of a trapped population and accused global leaders of complicity for their silence.
Demanding an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. It's clear that crisis engagement, even when controversial, remains a defining part of her public platform, regardless of whether she holds an official diplomatic title.
Absolutely.
We now pivot to her personal life, a subject that has generated more global media consumption than perhaps any other celebrity of her generation. Her highly unconventional relationships and family structure have been a constant source of scrutiny.
Her personal journey started early. The sources detail that at age 14, her mother allowed her serious boyfriend to live with them. Jolie explained, this was marshaling strategy to ensure she explored the relationship in a safe way, rather than being reckless on the streets. When the relationship ended at 16, she channeled that intensity right into her career.
Her first marriage to Johnny Lee Miller in 1996, it really set the tone for her early unconventional public image. She wore black rubber pants and a white t-shirt with his name written on it.
In her own blood.
In her own blood.
Yeah.
They divorced 4 years later due to demanding work schedules, but remained close friends.
And it's also important to note her relationship with model Jenny Shimizu, whom she met while filming Foxfire. Jolie stated that she probably would have married Shimizu had she not married Miller first. And when she was asked about her sexuality in 2003, she was entirely candid. Of course I'm bisexual. If I fell in love with a woman tomorrow, would I feel that it's okay to want to kiss and touch her? Absolutely.
Her second marriage, to Billy Bob Thornton in 2000, was the peak of the wild child media frenzy. They married quickly and were famous for public displays of affection, including wearing vials of each other's blood around their necks.
The marriage ended abruptly 3 years later, with Jolie stating they had totally changed overnight and suddenly had just nothing in common.
And then came the Brangelina phenomenon. Her relationship with Brad Pitt began while filming Mr. and Mrs. Smith in 2005. She publicly addressed the intense media scrutiny about Pitt's previous marriage, denying any infidelity. She cited her own father's infidelity as a deep barrier, stating she could not look at myself in the morning if she had done that to another woman.
Their 12-year relationship defines celebrity culture globally. They married in 2014, but separated 2 years later, divorcing in 2019. And the complexity of the separation continues to generate legal activity, notably a countersuit filed by Jolie following Pitt's lawsuit over their shared winery, which included allegations that he physically and verbally abused her and their children in 2016.
The construction of their large global family was central to the Brangelina narrative, bringing unprecedented attention to international adoption and multiracial families.
Maddox Chivon, adopted in 2002 from Cambodia, was the first, and as she noted, the anchor that stabilized her life. Zahara Marley, adopted in 2005 from Ethiopia, was the second. Pitt legally adopted both children in 2006, leading to the use of the Jolie Pitt surname.
The birth of their first biological child, Shyla Nouvelle, in Namibia in 2006, was a huge media event. The sources confirmed the first photos were sold for a then-record $7.6 million.
To People and Hello magazines, with all proceeds benefiting UNICEF. This set a precedent for strategic use of paparazzi interests for humanitarian gain.
Then came Pax Thien, adopted from Vietnam in 2007. This adoption was notable because Jolie initially had to adopt him as a single parent, as Vietnamese law barred unmarried couples from co-adopting at the time.
Right. Pitt adopted him the following year. Finally, the twins, Knox and Vivienne, were born in Nice, France in 2008. The first photos of the twins sold for a reported $14 million.
The most expensive celebrity photographs ever taken at the time.
Ever. With all proceeds channeled to the Jolie Pitt Foundation, this strategic control of their image was directly tied to funding her global initiatives.
And as a deeply meaningful recognition of her commitment to Cambodia, King Norodom Sihamoni granted her Cambodian citizenship in 2005 in honor of her humanitarian work there. It underscores how deeply integrated she became with the country.
This health crisis transformed her public persona more profoundly than perhaps any film role or diplomatic post. In 2013, at age 37, she revealed she had undergone a preventative double mastectomy.
This choice was made due to a defective BRCA1 gene, which caused an 87% risk of breast cancer. Her family history was tragically clear. Her mother and grandmother had both died of ovarian cancer.
And her aunt, with the same defect, died of breast cancer shortly after Jolie's surgery. The risk was incredibly high. The mastectomy successfully lowered her risk to under 5%. She took further preventive action in 2015, undergoing a preventive salpingo-oophorectomy, the removal of her ovaries and fallopian tubes, due to a 50% risk of ovarian cancer, a surgery that triggered premature menopause.
The revolutionary aspect wasn't the surgery itself, but her decision to go public with it. She detailed her surgeries and her rationale in op-eds published in the New York Times, using her platform to speak directly to millions of women facing similar choices. She explicitly wrote that the surgery did not diminish her femininity, stating she felt empowered that I made a strong choice.
This public disclosure created an immediate and massive global reaction, instantly dubbed the Angelina Effect by Time magazine. Her announcement led to a global and sustained surge in BRCA gene testing referrals. Referrals tripled in Australia and doubled in the UK and Canada. This was a direct, measurable impact on public health awareness on a global scale.
And there was a critical legal and financial consequence to her timing. Her high-profile advocacy coincided with a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that invalidated the BRCA gene patents, which had previously allowed one company to charge exorbitant fees for testing. Her public pressure likely contributed to the environment that saw those patents invalidated, drastically reducing the cost of testing for women worldwide.
Her image evolution is a study in converting cultural chaos into diplomatic capital. She moved from the wild child to a global icon of measured sophistication and humanitarian strength in a way no other celebrity has really achieved.
The 1990s and early 2000s were defined by the wild child narrative. Tabloids constantly covered her reported fascination with blood and knives, her drug history, bisexuality, and sadomasochism. Even the infamous kiss with her brother at the 2000 Oscars fueled incest rumors, which she had to publicly dismiss as a misunderstanding of their uniquely close emotional bond as children of divorce.
The critical shift began when she became a UNHCR Goodwill Ambassador at age 26. She summarized this transformation best herself, reflecting on her early years. In my early 20s, I was fighting with myself. Now I take that punk in me to Washington, and I fight for something important.
She effectively redirected her intense energy toward advocacy. And the effectiveness of this image overhaul is quantifiable. Her likability, or Q score, nearly doubled between 2000 and 2006. This is astonishing. She managed this radical public shift, transforming a reputation built on self-destruction into one built on compassion, often without using a traditional publicist.
Her star power and wealth gave her an unparalleled platform. Forbes named her the world's most powerful celebrity in 2009, and she consistently topped the list of highest paid actresses through 2013. She was also recognized twice by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Her visibility became a currency she could spend on policy and diplomacy.
Her physical presence and aesthetic have always been central to her influence. She was routinely cited by major publications like Vogue, People, and FHM as the world's most beautiful or sexiest woman. Her full lips, in particular, are noted as her single most recognizable feature.
Possessing an iconic status akin to Kirk Douglas's chin, her aesthetic was rebellious and highly symbolic. She has an estimated 20 tattoos, each a personal roadmap of her life and beliefs. These include the Latin proverb, quod me nutrit me, destruit, what nourishes me, destroys me, Buddhist Sanskrit prayers, and the geographical coordinates of where she met each of her children.
And notably, she consciously covered up older, less relevant tattoos, like the name Billy Bob, reflecting her emotional evolution.
The sources debate whether her dark and intense sexuality was purely an asset. While it fueled the success of action films like Lara Croft, some critics suggested that it sometimes limited her dramatic credibility in conventional roles. Despite these perceived limitations, her attributes became the gold standard of beauty sought after in cosmetic surgery well into the 2010s.
Her fashion evolution provided a clear visual marker of her changing status. She began with gothic styles, leather, and vampish looks, but strategically transitioned to a sophisticated, minimalist, old Hollywood glamour later in her career,
favoring custom Versace gowns and Grecian silhouettes. This shift cemented her status as a style icon, famously culminating in the black Versace gown with the high slit at the 2012 Academy Awards, which remains one of the most significant and memed fashion moments in internet history.
Looking across the entire breadth of her career, the volume and complexity of her work is truly staggering. She navigated a youth defined by self-destruction and rebellion, channeled that intensity into becoming an Oscar-winning actress, then used her massive profile as a foundation to become a dedicated director and a serious global diplomat.
We've seen that her success lies in her strategic approach. She didn't just donate money. She successfully translated massive bankable celebrity status, the Brangelina engine and her box office power, into actionable high-level influence. She affected international policy with PSVI, established vital legal aid infrastructure with KIND, and profoundly altered public health awareness with the Angelina effect. She truly redefined the scale and scope of what a modern movie star's global engagement could achieve.
It is clear that while the headlines may often focus on her relationships and appearances, the legacy stack of work, from directing war dramas based on personal trauma, establishing community-focused conservation models in Cambodia, to launching a global initiative against sexual violence and conflict, is immense and enduring.
Considering her lifelong commitment to fighting global conflict, violence, and injustice, does her extensive career transition from a successful action heroine in roles like Lara Croft to a highly effective anti-violence advocate demonstrate a powerful practical synergy between art and activism where the fame fueled the change? Or does the sheer weight and demand of her ongoing diplomatic work inevitably limit her capacity for continued output in film? What further global initiative could her unique leveraged influence launch next, now that she operates outside the official UN structure, focusing on global education or international law? It's a question that will define the rest of her public life.